Tales of congressional battles over health care and insurance are in the news daily of late, and even a careful listening with no interruptions can still leave you scratching your head over many of the details. It may help to look backward to understand how our health care system got to where it is. It came from a place where doctors were not held in very much esteem and did not make much money. And that takes us to today's America, where doctors make lots of money, and so do insurance companies and many other participants in the system. Paul Starr writes of the journey in The Social Transformation of American Medicine, The Rise of a Sovereign Profession, and the Making of a Vast Industry. Paul Starr is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. He founded the magazine of liberal thought, The American Prospect, with Robert Reich and Robert Kuttner in 1990, and still serves as a co-editor. The original version of the book, The Social Transformation of Modern Medicine, came out in 1982 and won the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction. Paul Starr, a pleasure to have you on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great to be with you this morning.
Were there several times, I have to believe, in the last 35 years you considered adding to the book?
Well, I resisted adding to it because there would be no end to the changes that I would have to make. Finally, after 35 years, I agreed to add an epilogue. It turned out to be much more substantial than I originally thought, trying to make sense of what's been happening in healthcare over the past 3.5 decades. And unfortunately, I had to send this to the printer just 2 weeks after the election, and consequently, I couldn't really resolve what is going to happen now. Well, we even these many months later, it's really not clear how this is all going to settle out.
Has anything you've seen in the intervening 3.5 decades since the original publication of the book, especially the last 8, shocked you in any way? I mean, is it these things you thought might happen?
I wouldn't say these developments have shocked me. So going back to the original edition of the book, the general storyline of that book is, as you already mentioned, early in American history, there wasn't really a strong medical profession. It was weak in its authority, limited in its income, uncertain in its social standing. And it was in the course of the 19th century that a tremendous change took place in Americans' view of medicine and, of course, what medicine was. And by the early 20th century, the medical profession emerged as much stronger, with licensing laws to back it up, and a whole set of institutions, including hospitals and public health agencies and so forth, that respected what I describe in the book as the sovereignty of the medical profession. For a long time, physicians really ruled over the entire system. But then, in the 20th century, there developed a much larger and more complex industry, the pharmaceutical industry, hospitals, many other types of organizations, interest groups that have emerged. And in that system, physicians have certainly remained very well compensated. They have a lot of influence, but they're only one of many interest groups in the political arena. And the system that we have now has been the product of many different forces. The 1982 edition ended with a chapter called "The Coming of the Corporation," about the rise of corporate healthcare. And 35 years later, that corporate system has arrived. It's no longer just coming. It is indeed there. And not only that, what I write about in the epilogue is the increased consolidation in the industry, the growth of monopoly power in almost all segments of the healthcare industry. So you see in many, many areas, there'll be just one or two hospital systems that completely dominate. And there's been a similar consolidation on the insurance side in many areas of the country. Now, there's some variation from one region to another, But this is now a much more top-down structured industry than it used to be.
I'm struck several times in the book, and maybe constantly is a better term for it, by the way that we not only revere medicine now, but also grumble about it a lot. And you write of the growth of the healthcare system and the persistence of national discord over it. I mean, are Americans yes. unique in the way that we seem to constantly criticize the system and the delivery and all that?
Well, I would say that healthcare for the last several decades has been a more central and more toxic issue in American politics than in any of the other major Western democracies. In most of those other countries, the big questions about health care were settled several decades ago, and they continue to argue about budgets and all kinds of policies, but what we've seen in this country the last several decades, and of course is going on right now, is that healthcare has become one of the most polarizing political issues in the country. And that's really a distinctive American phenomenon. And I think it goes back to the failure to resolve certain fundamental questions during the 20th century. And at the root of this, I think, has to do with a series of choices that were made that have made American healthcare incredibly expensive. So we spend much more of our national income on healthcare than do any of the other major countries in the world by a long shot. And that higher cost creates problems of affordability for individual people, and it creates enormous fiscal problems for government. And so at every level, there are pressures. And the different political parties, different ideological positions, have different views about how that problem should be dealt with.
All right. We'll deal with that in the next portion of our discussion with Paul Starr, the author of The Social Transformation of American Medicine, which is out in a reprinted version with a new preface and a new epilogue. Paul Starr, our guest on The Exchange. You can join the conversation when we come back in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, co-founder of the American Prospect, liberal magazine with Robert Reich and Robert Kuttner, still co-editor of that, and the author of The Social Transformation of American Medicine, which was completed in 1982, won the Pulitzer Prize the following year, and got an update this year with a new preface and epilogue. Obviously, a lot to talk about in American medicine, past, present, and future. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Paul, I'm still trying to figure out how medicine got from, and you mentioned standards, which is a big part of this, but this medicine essentially bucks a trend. This is book one in the book, The Rise of Professional Sovereignty, where medicine, rather than getting fragmented over the years, actually pulled its power together and became more of a monopoly.
Yeah, well, when you say medicine, you mean the medical profession.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that was part, and so if we go back to the 19th and early 20th century, there was a movement among a number of occupations to elevate their status, to develop higher standards, requirements for higher education, for training, specialized training, passing certain kinds of exams. This happened actually in the law. It happened in engineering. It happened in a whole series of fields. The physicians were extraordinarily successful in this effort to transform their own social position, and all of the related businesses, you know, the pharmaceutical business, medical equipment, all these other enterprises associated with healthcare. Basically accommodated the dominant position that physicians had in the whole clinical system. And that was an extraordinary achievement. Physicians enjoyed a tremendous amount of respect and authority. And then really, I mean, if you just jump forward, after World War II, particularly in the 1960s and 70s, there were a variety of consumer movements, the women's health movement, a variety of others that began to question whether a doctor's word should really be the final word, and whether people shouldn't have other information besides what they would get from their doctor, and a whole series of changes, laws about informed consent, a whole variety of changes in medical ethics took place that reflected some questioning of what once was that unquestioned position of the physician. And another part of it was the emergence of these new corporate organizations whose managers also began to exert some influence over what the physicians were doing. So there's been what I call in the book a waning of physicians. Sorry, it hasn't disappeared, but it is no longer quite as dominant as it was in the early and mid-20th century.
The early history of America, and you do take us back to colonial days here, who provided most health care before we thought that doctors should be the beginning point?
Oh, well, if we go back to the colonial period and early American history, most care of the sick took place within the family and the immediate community. And especially if you think about rural areas where a physician was not easily available, Americans were highly self-sufficient. There were a lot of books about of home remedies, what was called domestic medicine, which were a fascinating source of a popular culture about health. And this goes back to the 1700s, very, very early, because the level of literacy, at least among the white population in the North, in the northern states in the colonial period, was very high. And so you had these books of medical advice that give an interesting perspective on what people were doing outside of the sphere of physicians.
So it's almost like the WebMD of today. I get that sense. Where it was, you know, may not have been very effective, but it was very democratic.
Yes, and actually, when you read some of these books, they're not just superstitions. They're people trying to make sense of how to deal with practical problems of injuries and illness on their own. And actually, I think it's a very good aspect of American tradition.
Sociologist Paul Starr is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Social Transformation of Modern Medicine, first published 35 years ago and now out in a new edition with a new preface and epilogue. And you do get into, obviously, some historical stuff in here, but again, to talk about the consolidation of power of people in the medical profession. I mean, essentially, were doctors once held on sort of the same plane as people like the patent medicine salespeople and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, so if you, again, going back now to the 1830s, 40s, 50s, In that period, there were all kinds of people who represented themselves as being able to heal the sick, and there were very weak standards at the time. There was no effective licensing in that period. There were what were called proprietary medical schools, which were really operated by one or two doctors and had very minimal training. And so, yeah, there wasn't a firm sense of what it took to be a physician in anything like the way people understand that today.
Can you kind of point to a period in history, a decade or two within which we could finally say that, oh, you're a doctor, became a big deal in America?
I think that was already true by the 1880s and 1890s, but much more so by the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
That interval between the 1880s and the 1920s, there was a transformation of medical education and also a tremendous reduction in the number of medical schools. So those old fly-by-night proprietary schools were drummed out of the marketplace. State licensing laws made it impossible for them to continue. And the result of that was that the standards were raised, but also the number of trained physicians was limited. And in fact, the supply of doctors, especially in rural areas, fell very dramatically in the 1920s and 30s because of that reduction in the number of medical schools. So many areas no longer had somebody, even a poorly trained physician, to take care of the sick. And that helped to consolidate the professional monopoly for a long period of time. There was a real restriction on the supply of doctors.
And when too, Paul, did our attitude about why we go to doctors change? I mean, it seems like the way you describe it, it was originally sick care. You went to a doctor when you were feeling pretty bad, but then it eventually evolved to preventive care, and you'd go see a doctor just for sort of regular checkups and maintenance.
Oh, sure. And there's also been a tremendous expansion in the scope of medicine. So many things that previously weren't considered health problems, weren't considered problems appropriate for professional attention, now are. I mean, think of all the psychological developmental issues with kids and so forth. These would never have been brought to the attention of a medical professional 100 years ago. But now the scope of medicine is much more broadly defined.
Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, co-founder of the American Prospect and the author of The Social Transformation of American Medicine, won a Pulitzer Prize after its first edition came out 35 years ago. New edition out now with new preface and new epilogue. Paul's our guest on The Exchange. You can join the conversation about healthcare in America and how we got to where we are today. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Connie in Central Point. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. My question is, why does no one ever talk about the role of profit to shareholders? And when we're talking about discussion of how, for instance, the Affordable Care Act went way over budget. And, I mean, I really applauded President Obama when he was making healthcare available to everyone, but I was always surprised that he based it on the private health insurance industry, because he may mandate what needs to be covered, but not how much you can charge for it. And the funny thing is now the other party is trying to repeal and replace, but the last guys already took the standard Republican way of privatizing to make something better. So I think their options are fewer right now. But it seems to me that's just kind of like the elephant in the room that nobody talks about.
The profit in the healthcare system?
The profit in the healthcare system.
All right, let's get
to that. Where there's no cap, there's no limit. Nobody says you can only make so much profit, so people just charge what they can.
Okay, let's get a response. Thanks for that, Connie. Appreciate it. Paul?
Yeah, there's an awful lot in your question, and I agree there were no limitations placed on the profits of physicians or hospitals or insurance companies in the Affordable Care Act. Now, I don't agree with one premise of your question. You say the Affordable Care Act went way over budget. Actually, if you go back to the estimates that were made by the Congressional Budget Office at the time the law was passed, the numbers have worked out pretty close to what were projected, and in fact, overall spending is lower than was projected at that time. Now we've had a problem in the last year having to do with increased insurance rates in the individual health insurance market, those marketplaces that the Affordable Care Act created. But if you look back to 2010, when the law was passed, these increases this last year actually just brought the rates up to what were the original projected levels. Now, that we don't know, you know, if there was a genuine effort now to fix what were real problems. Talk about all the problems in the Affordable Care Act. If there was a genuine effort now to fix those problems, I think those rates could be stabilized, and there wouldn't be a fundamental problem there. You know, you're right. The Affordable Care Act, insofar as it expanded insurance through those marketplaces, did rely on private insurance companies. That was the model that came from Governor Romney's plan in Massachusetts. And the hope that Obama and Democrats had in 2009, 2010 was that if they adopted that approach from a Republican governor, who, as it turned out, was going to be Obama's opponent in 2012, you know, they could get some Republican support. It turned out they couldn't, in spite of the reliance on private insurance companies. And many Democrats wanted in that plan a public option. They wanted a Medicare-like plan to be available. And in retrospect, it was a great mistake that the law did not include a public option, because now what's happened in many areas of the country is that some of the private insurance companies have left the marketplace, and there is effectively no competition in many, especially rural areas. And what we would have had with a public option was a guarantee that there'd be some competition with at least the one remaining private plan. Typically, it's a Blue Cross plan in these areas. So, there were mistakes made in the Affordable Care Act, but there were mistakes made in Social Security in 1935, and then in the following years they passed amendments and they fixed a lot of the problems. There were mistakes made in Medicare in 1965, and in the years after that they passed amendments, they fixed some of the problems. It's really not a surprise that in 2010 some mistakes were made in the Affordable Care Act. It's hard to write a big piece, complex piece of legislation, get every detail right. But Democrats lost control of Congress in 2010. They've never had a chance to amend the law, to fix the problems in the law. And the result now is that the whole thing may be overturned.
Well, and of course, the people in charge in the House have been vowing since it passed to repeal and replace, and there's still some question about what's in there. I want to ask, though, your analysis of why the insurance rates have climbed up to where they were supposed to end up anyway, and how much the congressional cutting of funding for the so-called risk corridors plays into that.
Yeah, that is a factor. That is definitely a factor. Well, there's a tremendous amount of variation from one state to another in what has happened to insurance rates under the Affordable Care Act. So you can see some states like California that have done very well in maintaining competition and keeping down rates. But then there are other areas of the country where there has been very little competition, and some of the insurance companies have exited from the market. And those areas, they're typically rural areas. They're concentrated in the South and parts of the West. And those are the areas that have had the big increases. Now, those are the areas that really needed a public option. They needed a Medicare-like alternative because the marketplaces themselves were not competitive enough to begin with, and they've become less so over time.
I want to go back to square one here a bit, because insurance is actually the beginning of book two. I should point out that the social transformation of American medicine is set up as book one and book two. When did insurance first emerge in America, medical insurance, health insurance?
Well, there were forms of prepayment for health care that go back to the 19th century. And those took place very often in fraternal lodges, in other kinds of local arrangements through employers. In Oregon, that would have been through some of the lumber companies The mining companies had their own doctors. So those were kind of like insurance, but health insurance in the sense that we understand it today really began with the Blue Cross plans that emerged in the 1920s and 1930s. And those were initiated by hospitals that were facing financial problems of their own. And this is especially true during the Great Depression. And they worked with groups of with employers to create hospital insurance plans for their employees. And so there were teachers and various other groups who were the first to get some kind of health insurance. And then in the late 30s and 40s, commercial insurance companies entered the market, and we began to see a health insurance industry that looks a bit like the one that exists today.
Okay, we'll talk about efforts to provide insurance for broader swaths of people through American history as we continue our discussion with Paul Starr about the social transformation of American medicine. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Starr and your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Paul Starr, a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University and the co-founder of The American Prospect with Robert Reich and Robert Kuttner, still the co-editor of that magazine of liberal thought. It's tempting to say he wrote the book on American medicine, which is not entirely true, but he wrote a very big book on American medicine called The Social Transformation of American Medicine, The Rise of a Sovereign Profession and the Making of a Vast Industry. It came out in 1982 and won the Pulitzer Prize the following year. It has been reissued 35 years later with a new preface and a new epilogue tracking the changes in healthcare, and even that went to press just as Donald Trump was elected, therefore increasing the chance that the Obamacare would get repealed, which certainly is underway in Congress. You can talk about the whole mishigas, the whole collection of things that have happened in American healthcare for the last 230 or so years. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. In the section about insurance in book two, we were just talking about when insurance began to rise in America. One of the head-snapping moments in here is to see that capital and labor both opposed efforts to provide public insurance right around World War I.
Yeah, so if you go back just about 100 years, there was the first effort to pass health care legislation. This was at the state level, not the national level. And at that time, labor unions in the American Federation of Labor thought that they would provide health insurance directly to their members. And so at the very beginning of this whole issue, the labor unions were against having government do it because they wanted to provide the insurance themselves. And so did employers. They didn't want the government to get involved. If you go back to the very beginning of this, in fact, the American Medical Association originally thought health insurance from the government would be a great idea, would increase physicians' income.
Mm-hmm.
But both the unions and the American Medical Association flipped, changed their positions. And so the AMA then decided, oh, no, the government would be a terrible idea. And then later the unions decided, oh, no, we do want the government to come in. And by the 1930s, under Franklin Roosevelt, that was the lineup of the interest groups, with the AMA leading the opposition to any inclusion, for example, of health insurance in the Social Security legislation in 1935, and the unions being much more in support of that. This became a big issue under President Truman in the late 1940s. Truman was the first president who really made national health insurance a campaign issue in 1948, but he failed to get it adopted. And really, it's in that period in the first half of the 20th century that the politics of healthcare took its current shape, with conservatives lined up against government playing a bigger role in the financing of healthcare, and liberals in support of that position. So again, if you look at other countries, if you look at Great Britain, if you look at France and so forth, they all passed some kind of national legislation, created some kind of national system for paying for health care. And the conservative parties in those countries long abandoned any opposition to that idea. So it's just, it's not a source of division ideologically as it is in the United States.
Is it the position then of the conservative forces in the United States that this is about freedom? This is about our freedom to control our own fate? I mean, is this where that position tends to shape in America?
Yeah. That is a very distinctive aspect of the American politics of healthcare. That conservatives see this as an issue of freedom, and so you have one party that's at least ostensibly is emphasizing the issue of freedom, and the other the issue of equality. It's such a complicated issue politically. There are so many aspects of healthcare. I hate to kind of reduce it to that simple dichotomy.
I know, but because of the way the arguments are often cast, it tends to get down to what you can fit in a bumper sticker, which is why I asked the question. Let's bring in Pam and Dexter. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Starr, the author of The Social Transformation of American Medicine.
Hi. Well, I watched Michael Moore's Sicko quite a few years ago, and I think it was there, which I highly recommend because he goes to, you know, France and Canada and England and compares their universal healthcare system with ours. But I think it was in that documentary where he spoke with a doctor, I think he was from France, and they were saying that they actually, because it's a universal system that the government pays for, it behooves the doctors and the whole system to, instead of encouraging profits from people being sick, the doctors are rewarded for their patients to be healthy. So they actually make more income when they have less medical problems. So they're actively teaching their patients healthy lifestyles, healthy, you know, what to eat. I just think that's such a shift from how we look at our system towards healing and being healthy, rather preventative healthcare rather than, you know, the pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry, the health insurance industry and the hospitals all making money off of people getting sick. I just think that, you know, I don't know. I just wonder if you know more about that and if you could comment on that.
All right.
And I'll listen on the radio.
Thanks, Pam.
Thanks.
So as long as we pay physicians and hospitals fee for service, that is, one fee for every additional service that they do, they are going to have an incentive to do more. I mean, that is, you know, that's going to be built into fee for service. Now, there has been an effort to move away from that over the last several decades, and each one of those has created a reaction. That was the idea behind health maintenance organizations, HMOs. What was a health maintenance organization going to do? It was going to get a fixed amount of money for a population of patients, and it would then have an incentive to keep them healthy. But, of course, HMOs generated a tremendous amount of controversy and backlash, and now we have some other ideas that were represented in the Affordable Care Act. So, for example, under Medicare today, hospitals are being paid; they're being given what are called bundled payments. And so, instead of getting more money for each additional service they do for some episode of care, they're getting an amount of money that is supposed to give them an incentive to get people back on their feet and healthy as quickly as possible. Every time you do this, and I think many of these are good ideas. They're attempts to make the system more oriented toward health rather than sickness, just Pam, as you were saying. But each one of these has problems, and there is a potential for shortchanging patients. So it's inherently a difficult problem to solve.
You write in the epilogue of the book, and I want to make sure we do touch on that before we go, that despite the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, neither the public nor the private sector has been able to rationalize health care. I mean, what do you see as really needing to happen?
That's a complicated question. If we could deal with the problem of coverage in a way that achieved some kind of bipartisan consensus, we could get past some of these arguments that are now just destroying any sensible health care policy in this country. We need to figure out some way that everybody's going to get protected. And within that system, I do believe we could make things more efficient. I think we need to have some regulation of prices. That has become an unmentionable thing. But going back to the earlier question that somebody asked about profits, I do think we're going to need some kind of regulation of prices in the system, because the price system in healthcare makes absolutely no sense. People get charged all kinds of different amounts depending upon the kind of insurance they have. There's no transparency. You can't really get quoted prices in advance. There's no posting of prices.
There's no menu, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the whole price system does not work in healthcare, and it has allowed these dominant organizations. Earlier I talked about the growing monopolization in healthcare. It's allowed them to push up prices, to milk the payers, both the individuals and employers and government, for as much as they could. And we need to have a strong countervailing power in the marketplace, and I think that's going to have to come from public regulation.
Let's take another call from Don and Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange with Paul Starr.
Oh, this is very interesting. My personal experience, while I was living in Italy, I had a life-threatening operation problem, and it was solved by a brilliant surgeon 55 years ago. And that was a single-payer system, so I'm kind of biased. There was a study of comparing also with different health systems in different countries, and I remember that they concluded Taiwan had the most popular one. I think it was a single-payer system, but no one could run against the idea, but they were having trouble paying for it. Do you have an opinion about which country has the best system? I mean, that's a pretty big question.
All right. Thanks for that, Don.
I don't really have an opinion about it, but here's what I'd say. Many countries have reached a satisfactory resolution of these questions that is consistent with their broader institutions. They've worked out some way to deal with healthcare that fits with their culture, with their political system. We haven't. We're still fighting over the most basic questions about the financing of healthcare. And I could imagine many satisfactory ways. I don't think there's one correct way to do this. It's getting past the fruitless, toxic arguments that now dominate our politics, and figuring out some way that we can reach a consensus that is at least satisfactory to people on both sides.
So that brings us right to the doorstep of the current events. I mean, the Senate is not voting this week anyway on its version of Obamacare repeal, but with Mitch McConnell being the Senate Majority Leader and him being a very tough and time-tested politicians. Is there any doubt that there will be that vote eventually?
Well, I don't know whether the Senate will actually vote on this. If they can't, if the Republicans don't have a majority, McConnell may not bring it to the floor. But I would guess they will pass some legislation either now or later this year. There are a variety of ways that they could do it. I would prefer to see them turn to some kind of bipartisan negotiations. And there is some talk about that in today's papers. But most likely this is going to be something like the bill that that McConnell released earlier with some modifications. There's bargaining going on. I think there's a lot of posturing going on right now with some of the senators who want to extract sessions. But one thing is, I think is clear. Even if Republicans pass this legislation and Trump signs it, it's not going to last as a permanent solution. It's just going to create, just going to set the stage for more warfare. Because when you look at the details of this, it's going to impose tremendous costs on low-income people. It's going to cost many people their health insurance. I just can't believe that we're going to end up with that as a stable resolution.
We will certainly see, but we certainly get some great lessons in how we got to this moment in American history through the book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine, published in 1982, won the Pulitzer Prize the following year, just re-released with a new preface and epilogue from Paul Starr, who's been our guest in the exchange. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.